Hello friends, welcome to Camp Kaiju, where we break down a different monster movie each episode. We're talking the good, the bad, and the downright campy. Kaiju are fun, and all strange beasts are welcome here. We're your hosts, Vincent Hannum and Matt LeSpleen Levine. Camp Kaiju is brought to you by BanditsEmporium.com, your favorite shop for unique t-shirt merchandise, and the official t-shirt partner of Camp Kaiju. Long sleeves, short sleeves, red shirts, blue shirts, soft shirts. Oh, you know you love their shirts. Well, now you can use promo code Camp Kaiju at checkout for a 10% discount. Go to BanditsEmporium.com or hit the link in our bio. Hey, whatever your style, BanditsEmporium.com has you covered. As they say, we sell shirts. We are talking about the 1961 British kaiju film, and this one is titled Gorgo. Not Godzilla, Gorgo. Ergo.
easy to confuse the two.
Matt, how you doing?
I'm doing great. It's good to see you again and talk about movies. How are you?
I'm good. I was just in England, which is part of my reason for bringing Gorgo to Camp Kaiju. I just thought, why not tie it into my own travels overseas?
Did you see any like Gorgo inspired like sites while you were in England?
I was actually on the lookout for Gorgo memorabilia. Last time I went to England, I had never heard of Gorgo. This time I was ready for it. I went into like several vintage stores, record shops, sort of those nerdy pop culture types of stores. I asked the guy because he saw me looking at some Frankenstein posters. And I was like, do you have any Gorgo things?
Did he know what you were talking about?
He thought about it. He was like, oh, like that Godzilla thing? I was like, yes.
At least he kind of knew. That's good.
Yeah, he kind of knew. Anyways, he took me to a rack of DVDs and he pointed, there was no Gorgo. There was just a bunch of Gamera DVDs. And I was like, well, close.
Yeah, as close as you can get, I guess.
Yeah, but then I thought I couldn't even buy those DVDs because I don't think the international discs would play in my American DVD player.
Right, and probably Gamera is like pretty easy to find in the United States, so you don't necessarily have to get the British version.
All of the Gamera movies are streaming on Amazon Prime.
Awesome, that is good. It's
great. I'm halfway through the series. Would recommend. Were you familiar with Gorgo at all?
No, not at all. When you brought up this movie, I had no idea what you were talking about. But I'm so delighted that you brought it up to me. It's great. I loved it. Not to get ahead of ourselves, but yeah. What a pleasant surprise.
When you first heard the name Gorgo, what popped into your head?
It's actually a Hammer horror film. The Gorgon was the first thing that I thought of, which is one of my favorite Hammer horror films. It's like, you know, like a lot of Hammer films from the 60s, it has like really artificial sets, like super bright colors and like really garish costumes and everything. So the Gorgon, the Hammer horror version, is awesome. So at first I thought that's what you were talking about, but no, Gorgo is totally different and really delightful.
But also British, just like the Hammer horror films.
Yeah, very British for sure.
So I don't know, just like the Technicolor of Gorgo reminds me of the Technicolor of some of those Hammer films.
Yeah, totally. And kind of like the, you know, I love those like really obviously artificial sets where they like clearly shot it on some like studio backlot, you know?
Yeah.
I love that look, and you don't really see that in movies anymore, which is kind of a shame. Like, you know, they're not really trying to be realistic. They just look so like bright and colorful and ridiculous. It's really a pleasure to behold.
Yeah. British cinema is certainly its own aesthetic. I feel like that just being in England recently, my brother over there was mentioning all these old movies. I was like, nope, never heard of it, never seen of it, because it's a British film, cult classic or whatever.
Yeah.
So yeah, there's a lot to explore there for sure.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I love Powell and Pressburger. I love David Lean. So, you know, like sort of like the classics of British cinema, I feel like I know pretty well. But yeah, for sure. Like those deep dive sort of like, you know, underseen gems. I definitely have to explore some of those a little bit more.
It's a shame Gorgo never had any sequels or anything like that.
Yeah. And, you know, it's kind of sad to hear that, like, the guy that you talked to in England while you were there, like, sort of knew what you were talking about, but, like, it's kind of like a vague, distant memory. Like, I feel like Gorgo should be as prominent in England as Godzilla is in Japan, you know?
I think so, or King Kong in America. Yeah. Like, this is the British kaiju.
Yeah, totally.
They should take it and run with it and rejoice in that glory.
Yeah.
The glory of Gorgo.
One would think, yeah, maybe it's not like quite at those movies levels, but I'm sure we'll get a little bit more into that soon. But yeah, I mean, like, this movie, I feel like should be a little bit better known than it is, you know?
Yeah, I think it's really well known within like horror monster movie circles. And like, cause like it was even featured on Mystery Science Theater 3000. Mm. So just because of that, it does have a following, but yeah, not like a widespread cultural awareness that I think it could have.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Maybe we can make that happen.
Let's do it. All right. Before we get into the synopsis and tell everybody all about this film, I will say there will be spoilers because you can't talk about Gorgo without some twists and turns that happen in this plot. Before we get into that, I want to give a shout out to everybody and thank you for listening and supporting. Please rate and review Camp Kaiju wherever you podcast. And I want to give you a sneak peek into what we're doing next month in June when summer kicks off full gear. No pun intended. We will be taking a road trip. Matt and I are going to explore car-themed monster movies, which, yes, is a subgenre of this genre. Movies like, I mean, we're only going to talk about two movies next month. We're going to tell you what those are at the end of this episode. So stay tuned, listen to the full thing, and you'll get a sneak peek into our roadside attractions next month.
Road trip.
Can't wait to play around the editing with this one. I'll do some car themed music or something.
Oh, nice. Some like revving of the engine sounds, maybe.
Yeah. Squealing tires.
Yeah, totally.
So, Gorgo, 1961, starts off with a man. He's a captain. His name is Joe Ryan, and he is salvaging for treasure off the coast of Ireland when a volcano erupts, nearly sinking his ship. Ryan and his first officer, Sam Slade, take the ship to Nara Island, a fictional place off the coast of Ireland, for repairs. As they enter the harbor, they discover the floating carcasses of marine animals, the first hint that something dangerous was awoken by the volcano eruption.
So Ryan and Slade make it to the shore, and they befriend a little orphan boy named Sean. Sean has them wait for the harbor master, who has also been salvaging in the harbor. Some of his men have disappeared mysteriously, and one has even died of fear. Later after dark, a monstrous 65-foot-tall creature surfaces, attacks a group of fishermen, then comes ashore to wreak havoc on the island. The people of Nara Island finally drive off the creature by throwing torches at it.
Ryan and his crew manage then to capture the monster and haul it aboard their ship, tying it to the deck. Sean, meanwhile, keeps warning them that this is a bad idea and even tries to free the monster. Soon, however, university scientists arrive at Nara, hoping to collect the monster for study, but Ryan has already sold the creature to Dorkin Circus in London. When the ship arrives in London, the circus owner, again named Dorkin, names the monster Gorgo. After the iconic snake-haired Gorgon Medusa, and exhibits it to the public. I just want to say the emphasis, I believe, is on the first syllable of Gorgo, not Gorgo.
Gorgo would be the French pronunciation. Yes. This is the British pronunciation, Gorgo. So the scientists examine Gorgo and conclude that he is not yet an adult and that his mother must be at least 200 feet tall. On that note of foreboding, we cut to Nara Island as Ogra, the mother of Gorgo, attacks.
Ogra trashes the island, sinks a Royal Navy vessel, and resists attack from other warships. Later, Ogra comes ashore in London, still looking for her son, and goes on a rampage, despite being bombarded by tanks, jets, and infantry. Having demolished much of London, Ogra rescues Gorgo, and both mother and son return to the sea.
Sort of a victorious ending for Ogra and Gorgo, which is kind of good to see, I think.
Yeah, it definitely strikes a different tone in terms of monster movies, where this time the giant monsters survive, which does not happen very often. I can't even think of another example off the top of my head.
Yeah, I can't remember. We talked about Godzilla versus Biollante recently. Does Biollante survive at the end of that? I think maybe he or she does. She?
Yeah, it's ambiguous. Certainly the spirit of Biollante survives and transcends.
Maybe that's what I'm thinking of. And then we see Godzilla sort of re-entering the sea. Totally. I was struck by how rare that is and how it's kind of like an optimistic ending in a way.
Yeah. Yeah. So Gorgo, ladies and gentlemen, the cast and crew is actually more interesting than I thought. They weren't super interesting to watch on screen, but the talent nonetheless is pretty interesting. So we have a man named Bill Travers. He plays Captain Joe Ryan. Bill Travers didn't really do much of note, I would say, in his career. At least, what do I know? I just didn't recognize any of his titles on his IMDb. But another man named William Sylvester, who plays his friend Sam Slade, also has a big role in Stanley Kubrick's 2001 A Space Odyssey.
And the entire time while I was watching Gorgo, I was like, where do I know this guy from? Like, I knew it like so vividly. And then, I saw that he was in 2001 after. And I was like, of course, he's a good presence because he doesn't really have to do very much, but he's still kind of like a good sort of like dry professional presence, you know?
That's great. I have not seen 2001 since I was in high school. So I was watching William Sylvester thinking he was just a no-name actor, but there you go. I don't know anything.
2001 is one of my favorite movies, and I've seen it 10 times, probably around there. So like, I knew that I had seen them so often before. So it was kind of good to read about that afterwards.
That's crazy that he's like in Gorgo. Another crazy actor here, the kid actor who plays Sean, who's probably 11 or 12, I'd say, in the film. His name is Vincent Winter, and I looked into his filmography. He grew up and became really involved behind the camera. He was the production manager on movies like For Your Eyes Only and even Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. And he worked on like the first three Superman movies with Christopher Reeves as like assistant director or production director. So I thought that was like, I was like, good for you, little orphan boy. And then the director, who it looks like you are also familiar with, Eugene Laurie.
Yeah, I wasn't really too familiar with him before watching this movie, but doing a little more research about him. He did make some sci-fi movies in the 50s. The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms, The Giant Behemoth being two of those. But I was really fascinated to read that he also worked with Jean Renoir earlier in his career, including on two of the best movies ever made, Grand Illusion and The Rules of the Game. He was an assistant director and a set designer on both those movies. So It's, you know, between Eugene Laurie and Vincent Winter, it's kind of just a sign of like, you never know what direction your film career is going to take, which is sort of delightful.
That is the best way to put it.
Whether for better or worse, you know.
Yeah, and we are saying we're making light of their participation in Gorgo, but I think that's unfair to the film Gorgo because it's really well done, and I think it's high points credited to the talent on the screen and behind the screen for sure.
Totally, we'll talk more about this soon, but it's a really well made movie, really fascinating. And, you know, one of the reasons that we have this podcast to begin with is because you can find so much greatness and creativity and urgency and originality in movies like this. So this is a prime example of that, I would say.
Yeah. And then the last crew member I want to say this, I only came upon this like minutes before we hit record. The cinematography is by Freddie Young. And I don't know who that was, but I do know Lawrence of Arabia. And I was just like, wait, the same guy who shot Lawrence of Arabia shot Gorgo?
Yeah.
Wow.
I think he worked with David Lean pretty often. He worked with him on Dr. Zhivago and Ryan's Daughter, I believe, as well.
Okay.
So he shot some really beautiful movies.
Wow. And yeah, I do think Gorgo is really well shot and looks really good.
Totally agreed.
Yeah. Despite I do have misgivings about this film, but the look of this movie is not one of them.
Yeah, even if I didn't know his sort of like pedigree or whatever, like just by watching the film, you're like, this is so capably made. And like, you could tell that it has like a very, not just capable, but sort of like innovative cast and crew behind the scenes, you know?
Yeah. And I've seen this movie a couple times now, actually three times. So I saw it last year and I was kind of like, meh, okay. That was a monster movie. I saw it 3 days ago. I actually saw the Mystery Science Theater 3000 episode. But because of my jet lag, I fell asleep halfway through it. But then the next day I was like, okay, I actually have to watch Gorgo again, like sincerely. So yeah. I did. And I'm glad I did.
You gave it the attention it deserves.
Yes. Real quick, I just want to say more about Eugene Laurie and The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms. That movie, and Matt, forgive me if you already know all this, but that movie inspired Godzilla. Ishiro Honda to create Godzilla, which in turn inspired Gorgo, also directed by Laurie. So Eugene Laurie came full circle in his kaiju pedigree. The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms is also notable for the stop motion animation of Ray Harryhausen. Did not work on Gorgo, but but Gorgo features some pretty great special effects that we'll get to later on. For now, I want to let you know about Camp Kaiju's t-shirt partner and sponsor, banditsemporium.com. Go check out their website, buy a t-shirt. All proceeds not only support them, obviously, but do support us as well. And right now you can use promo code Camp Kaiju, that's one word, to get 10% off your next purchase. You can get a cool shirt like the one Matt is wearing right now, but they have other designs as well and more to come. So banditsemporium.com, whatever your style, they have you covered. As they say, we sell shirts. Okay, production backstory. Matt, do you want the baton?
Sure, yeah. So Gorgo was an Irish-British-American co-production, which, you know, the Irish-British co-production is sort of an interesting aspect at this point in time in the early 60s. We'll get into that a little bit more later. It was produced by the King brothers, who actually had released Rodan in the United States and found a lot of success releasing that movie there. So, you know, that's kind of why they wanted to continue their success with kaiju movies, put Gorgo into production. They were originally going to film the movie in Japan, sort of as an homage to Godzilla. The Japanese funding kind of fell through, so they put the kibosh on that. They were then going to shoot the film in France and realized that like not having like a major port in France kind of made it difficult to like have these like great sort of like naval battles and like sort of scenes set at, you know, on the scene in the ocean.
Yeah.
So finally they shot it in the British Isles. Actually, a lot of it was shot on a soundstage in a London suburb. Bowen Hammond or something like that. I maybe have that wrong. It's like the most British name ever, but
yeah.
And then they shot some of it in London itself, and then in what's the name, Core Harbor, I think, near Dublin in Ireland.
Nice.
So a lot of it was shot on location. Laurie, the director, Eugene Laurie, originally did not want to include a lot of scenes of city attacks or military destruction. Which maybe seems kind of weird because that is like the majority of this movie and the majority of most kaiju movies. So
yeah,
the producers kind of insisted. And in my opinion, that kind of worked out in the end because those are some of the best scenes in the movie, in my opinion. So yeah, this was released when giant monster movies were beginning to wane in popularity in the West. You know, Godzilla, the original Japanese movie, had come out in 1954. So by this time, there was kind of, not a lot of audiences clamoring for this kind of thing in England, yeah, and the United States and elsewhere. So didn't do great, critically or commercially, as far as I know, but I feel like being featured in Mystery Science Theater 3000 is kind of like an indication of that it has sort of like a cheesy reputation.
Right.
But I would say that reputation is not totally earned personally.
Yeah, right. Like Mystery Science Theater 3000, like the Amazing Colossal Man to me is prime MST3K material. Gorgo, that's why I was like, I was even watching that episode and I was thinking like, yeah, the jokes are funny, but Gorgo's kind of actually a good movie.
Yeah.
the roasting doesn't come off as well as like a blatantly cheesy B movie.
Yeah, like I love MST3K, but I feel like that's kind of the downside of it. Like, it makes it very hard to appreciate what actually is like valuable in the movie that they're ridiculing the whole time, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
I did just want to correct a few things that I said. Sorry. So it was shot in the London suburb of Borehamwood and also shot on location in Coleymore Arbor. I just didn't want to get that totally wrong, so I wanted to correct myself.
That's good. Good editor's note there.
Yeah.
I wanted to add that I did not realize that these King brothers had brought Rodin to the United States and Western theaters. That is also just another very interesting connection between Gorgo and, I would say, kaiju royalty.
Yeah, I mean, like, the King brothers, it seems between this and Rodin, you know, they had a major hand in influencing, like, the popularity of these movies in the United States. So for that alone, they deserve a lot of credit.
Yeah, okay, and then I just remembered the other thing, this kind of moving away from production history and more into themes. Gorgo not only has a happy ending for the monster, but Gorgo is not a monster born of any sort of radioactive fallout, which is unique in this time period for monster movies. Yeah, and I just think that Gorgo represents maybe a transition away from that convention that I appreciated.
Yeah, I feel like the theme here is kind of a little more broadly, like, nature will persevere and sort of like will conquer over man, which, yeah, it's like a nice change of pace from Godzilla. Although I love that Godzilla and so many of those movies are very much about nuclear anxiety and sort of like the devastation that man can create. But yeah, this kind of like broader theme of man versus nature is equally compelling, I would say.
Because how is Gorgo even brought forth? I would use the pronoun that the characters in the movie used, he's unleashed by a volcanic blast. So already that's not even like man-made, I don't think. It's just like, right, a random chance of nature, mm-hmm, which is terrifying because, you know, things like that they're just random to us. And then Eugene Laurie he infuses this movie with a really interesting theme of child innocence, of kids being this vessel of purity. And this was due to his own daughter who watched The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms and complained to her dad, the director, that he had the kaiju in that movie killed off. So he was like, all right, I hear you, little girl. I will give this new one a happier ending. I love that personal touch.
Me too. I love that too. And I think we kind of see that childlike innocence in the character of Sean as well, the orphan boy who kind of tags along with Joe and Sam on their quest and has a lot of sympathy for Gorgo as well. I think Sean and Gorgo and Ogra are kind of seen as like innocent creatures in a way, you know, like natural, untainted by the sort of greed and self-absorption of man, you know?
Yeah, Sean is the inclusion of Sean in this movie opens the door to a lot of deeper conversations, I feel like, regarding themes. Because yes, like on the surface, Sean actually is the archetype or child sidekick to the monster that you see in a lot of those classic Gamera movies, for instance. There's always and later Godzilla movies in the 60s, there's always a kid involved. And yes, that like mirrored the transformation of the monster genre from adult themed horror movies into kid friendly, you know, Saturday morning popcorn fare. But looking deeper at that, Sean is an orphan. Sean he never mentions his mother. Sean's first line is literally, I don't have a father. Yeah. And that specificity is really interesting to me. He does not mention a mother. And then branching off of that are two male protagonists, Joe and Sam. They both become father figures to Sean. And the first time I watched Gorgo, I was like, I'm going to be really impressed if like there is like a same-sex parental reading of this film, mm-hmm, from 1961 British cinema. But that's the reading I think that the movie is sort of just begging you to dig into.
Yeah, totally agree. And actually, I watched it with my partner Kelly last night, and Kelly said to me while we were watching it, like, these guys are like a married couple. Like, they're inseparable. They do everything together until they have kind of like a, a difference of opinion about like how to treat Gorgo and like how to approach that situation. They have a little bit of a falling out, which is kind of like an emotional crisis for them, and then they're able to sort of like reconnect by the end, but yeah, you're totally right. They're like a sort of surrogate family, and I think the fact that there is one female character with dialogue in this movie, and she is a reporter that doesn't have a name, a character name. And like that could easily be seen as a weakness for sure, that there are no female characters in this movie of substance. But it seems intentional to me, and I think that you're right, that it does sort of like beg that interpretation that these men, Joe and Sam, along with Sean when he kind of comes into their lives, they have this really, kind of loving relationship. And it's yeah. Oh, it's weird. I was kind of thinking of Jurassic Park and like the Sam Neill, Laura Dern characters, and how they have these sort of like, they don't have kids themselves, but Laura Dern's character kind of wants to. And then there's the theme of like nature will always find a way, in Jurassic Park. So I don't know. There were some sort of unexpected parallels with that movie too. But in Gorgo, it's two men instead of a man and a woman, which is pretty perhaps not intentional, but I think still radical for its time,
I do, even if it is unintentional, which I don't think it is, because every movie in this genre has at least one female who plays the love interest, who plays the damsel in distress. I have to believe someone on the creative team said, "Hold up, guys, our monster movie's not gonna have a hot babe in this in the movie." And someone said, "Yeah, I don't want women in my movie," which could be misogynist, or it could be an attempt at a deeper meaning on male friendship and relationships, romantic or not.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's like surprisingly affecting, it's kind of a riff on King Kong in a way, because they do take Gorgo back to London and they like display it as the eighth wonder of the world and that sort of thing that we also saw in King Kong. But here in this case, there's like an ideological disagreement between Joe and Sam. Joe is like, yes, let's make money off of this. This is all about like our own fame and power. And Sam is like, no, this is like a living creature. We should sort of, like at first he's kind of willing to go along with it. And then like he definitely has moral issues with it as the movie goes on, and even kind of turns to alcohol a little bit to sort of deal with that. So it's surprisingly affecting, I think, when they have that falling out and then they're sort of forced to join forces again by the end.
There is definitely that kind of dynamic there. Do you prescribe to the, I mean, I know you do because you're a film buff, but in classic movies, cigarettes represented repressed sexuality.
Sure, a phallic symbol, yeah.
Do you believe that every time someone is smoking a cigarette, it is meant to mean more than just smoking a cigarette? Because if you do, Joe and Sam, they're always smoking. And I was like, ah, there it
There
is.
it is again, yeah.
There's the
Yeah.
subtext.
I don't think every time, but I certainly think that directors were probably aware of that, I think Double Indemnity is the best example of that, and the sort of like homoerotic relationship between Edward G. Robinson and Fred McMurray, and the fact that Ed Robinson always lights McMurray's cigar. And yeah, I mean, like, I think it's definitely there, and like intentionality doesn't always matter. I think like that symbolism is here in Gorgo to pick up on, and I love that about it.
I did too. So that's my take on it. I think you can watch Gorgo and not think about that, and it's still just a blast. But if you want a little bit of deeper meaning out of this movie, I think it's there to pick up on.
Yeah, totally. Do you mind if I bring up another theme that I thought was maybe like under the surface, but still there to pick up on?
Please, I want to know.
I just think it's fascinating that this was an Irish-British co-production in 1961. And, like certainly on the surface, there are no themes about like the animosity between those two countries, Britain and Ireland. But, in the early 60s, like, the violence that would lead to the troubles in the late 60s was certainly starting to like coalesce. There had been animosity for centuries, and still, like we're for, there was for many decades, several decades after this. So I think like reading Gorgo as like a beast representing Irish history and Irish culture, sort of like being taken to England and sort of like wreaking havoc in London, and then sort of like returning to its home to sort of like run free or whatever. Again, I don't know how intentional that was. And the fact that there were both Irish and British production companies, it probably was not intentional, but I just think it's such a like fascinating depiction of this time. And like, you know, metaphorically, I think you could read in some of those like political tensions in the story, you know?
I can buy that because Gorgo and Ogra come from the seas of Ireland, 100%. Yeah. Again, whether or not it was intentional, maybe doesn't matter, because it just deepens our enjoyment of the film.
Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, like initially when they do go to Nera Island, there are all these sort of local fishermen who are speaking a foreign dialect and that's not subtitled. And we don't really know what they're saying. Like little things like that. You know, I do think that the film is leading us to sort of like recognize that the place where Gorga comes from and Ogra is very different than where they end up. And yeah. I just think that's pretty fascinating. Yeah.
Yeah. And one more theme, I didn't realize it'd be so much in Gorgo. I like what you just said, starting in one place and then ending up where they didn't think they would be. Mm-hmm. I just, you know, had to do a little bit of historical research into Britain in 1961. It was a little bit before the swinging 60s that we picture, London 60s, Austin Powers type stuff. But it was definitely on the cusp. By the late 50s. Things were starting to change from the conservative, bleak post-war rubble that was London after World War II. And I think now that we've just talked about maybe a repressed homosexuality in our characters and this Irish liberation sort of thing, I think those themes portend the real life cultural shift that was happening in Britain in the early 60s.
Yeah, absolutely. I love that. It kind of made me think of a movie Victim by Basil Dearden from England from, I'm not going to remember exactly when, I think it's 1964 or something like that. And it's a story about a gay lawyer, or maybe he's a judge actually, who sort of represents a man who is also gay and is blackmailed for being gay at a time when homosexuality was illegal in England.
Yeah.
Really, really great movie, Victim. And it came out, if I remember right, like maybe 3 or 4 years after this one. So
okay.
I think Gorgo, although it sounds kind of ridiculous to say, maybe is like looking forward to movies like that, which is, I would not have expected. And it's pretty cool.
Alan Turing, the man, the World War II hero who invented what became the computer, tragically was sterilized by the British government in the 50s for being a homosexual. So like it was a big deal to be gay at that time in England.
Yeah, absolutely.
So
yeah. So, you know, like if the makers of Gorgo did want to like show a relationship like that, then the way that they do so in the movie is probably the only way they could have gotten away with it. You know,
they could not have been as explicit as they wanted to with Sam and Joe's relationship, because it just wouldn't fly.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, like it's like on the beginning cusp of like the swinging era, like swinging London or whatever. But it's also like on the late cusp of like the post-war era, as you mentioned. So we have these scenes in Gorgo where, you know, when people are trying to evacuate London, we have like these riots and this mayhem of people sort of like rushing into the underground. There's actually a scene where Joe is carrying Sean in his arms and Sean seems very traumatized by it.
Yeah.
And there's, you know, there's even a narrator in the movie who directly says it's like reminiscent of the Blitz from World War II.
Yeah.
I just think that the movie, you know, it's a pretty, again, an interesting depiction of like where England had been recently and where it was going in the near future. Mm-hmm. And to like sort of see that sort of thing in a monster movie where you might not have expected it. Really impressive. Yeah.
Totally. All right. Our final verdicts are going to be really interesting.
Yeah.
This one.
Indeed.
I really love the special effects in this film with the suitmation, but also the miniature model work of the city of London, iconic landmarks like Tower Bridge, Big Ben, they look really good and they crumble really well. It's just, it's good stuff. Grade A monster mayhem.
There's a shot of Big Ben being destroyed by, must be Ogra at that point.
Yeah.
But it's an amazing shot. Like it's like lit from behind with like a bright red light, and there's all this like fog sort of drifting through the scene. It's just like the coolest shot I've ever seen in a monster movie, which I know sounds hyperbolic, but it was like so beautiful. I loved it.
No, the lighting was really great and the use of fog. Also, there were a lot of great underwater camera work, which by our standards today, it's like not actually great. But back then, I don't think it was very common to have actual shots underwater.
Yeah, so totally.
I was impressed.
Yeah, me too. And I think even some of the sort of like very artificial underwater footage is like really, beautiful and charming in its own way. And actually reminded me of The Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou, the Wes Anderson movie. It's a very sort of like fantasy land version of like underwater exploration. And there's a scene here in Gorgo where Joe goes in a submersible and he like tries to sort of find Gorgo underwater. And mm-hmm. it's like, it could be out of The Life Aquatic. Like it has that same kind of handmade, like do it yourself sort of special effects, you know?
Cool.
And I just love that sort of thing. It looks really, really cool. Yeah.
So do you want to get to our personal breakdowns?
Yeah, let's do it.
Cool.
So for the good, there is a lot to like about this movie, as has probably been very clear from our conversation so far. Great special effects, beautiful cinematography, more themes than I really thought would be in this movie before I watched it. You know, we have the sort of like repressed homoerotic relationship between Joe and Sam. We have sort of a reflection of England and Ireland at this time, as well as their past and their future. One other thing that I would put in the good category is the use of found footage in this movie. And that's, you know, like that's not always a great thing. Sometimes it's a sign of like a low budget and like they're not able to like shoot the footage themselves.
Yeah.
But some of the footage in this movie of like submarine attacks and like aerial attacks and things like that, which very clearly is found footage because it's like a totally different film stock and it looks completely different than the other footage. Yeah. It's so beautiful. And like, again, you know, like it seems almost experimental in a way. I don't think it was meant to be like a comment on like, you know, different kinds of film stock, but it's just like a wonder to behold. It really kind of makes the film so dazzling to watch and so much fun.
Nice. I echo a lot of that. The suit in particular really impressed me with how many points of articulation it had. Like its ears move, its eyes blink. There's just a lot of moving parts that add to the realism of the suit. I love that it's in color, which is like, it's brilliant Technicolor, which it didn't need to be, you know, in this genre, black and white was pretty standard, but it really adds, I think, to the staying power of the film and allows you to enjoy it all the more. Mm-hmm. Also, Gorgo and Ogre have like bright red eyes and you just would miss out on that with a black and white film. I love the amalgamation of different inspirations. It's like parts King Kong, it's parts Godzilla, parts 20,000 Fathoms, of course. And the twist of this movie when the humans realized that Gorgo is not the main monster, that there's a bigger one coming and it's Mama. Yeah, the first time that happened caught me completely off guard in all the best ways.
Yeah, that's so well done. And like the moment when we first see Ogre, you know, open her eyes and it's like you said, it's that like bright red. It's so, so cool. So fantastic. Yeah.
Yeah. It's good stuff. The bad.
Yeah. I mean, like the editing can be a little sloppy sometimes, I would say. It's hard to know like which characters are where and like how they get from one place to another sometimes. That's only in some scenes. It's not all the time, but it does seem to be a little bit like, maybe some scenes were kind of like rushed or haphazard a little bit. You know, it does kind of seem like a Godzilla ripoff, although I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. Like you can sort of see that, like, you know, they wanted it to be an homage to Godzilla and then they kind of just like took that premise from there and ran with it. So I wouldn't necessarily put that in the bad category. Honestly, not a lot of other stuff, not a lot in the bad category for me.
All right. That's okay. You don't have to hate it. I was harder on this movie coming into it, maybe because I have seen so many kaiju movies that the story of Gorgo left me really uninspired and underwhelmed. Because while I love that it takes inspiration from so many other films, The drawback is that it leaves very little originality to the film, to the story of Gorgo itself. It's the King Kong story of capturing the monster, taking it to showbiz. It's the Godzilla story of a giant reptile rising from the depths. Eugene Laurie does repeat some beats that he had made with 20,000 Fathoms. Still very well done, but maybe a little uninspired. The utter lack of female representation, like if it's intentional, like I understand that. And clearly we get on board with that. However, if you're not prepared to think critically about that, it left me a little jarred. Like I've just never seen a movie with basically 99% men on the screen. It threw me for a loop in a weird way.
Yeah. I totally, that absolutely makes sense. Like I was trying to think of like, what would be the female character in this movie? And Oprah. I'm actually sure. Yeah, of course. But if there was like a human female character, like, sure. And in a way, like, I'm sort of happy they didn't try to like awkwardly insert like a love story or like a sort of like surrogate mother figure, you know?
Yeah.
So yeah, like more of like a substantial female presence would have been welcome for sure. But also I think like there is a lot of like tokening of female characters in some movies like this, you know?
Yeah.
So in a way I'm like also glad that they didn't do that.
100%. It's one of those catch 22s for me where
yeah.
It's like it's neither wrong or good. It's just Gorgo.
I love it. That should have been the tagline of the movie. That's perfect.
Yeah. It's neither wrong nor good. It's just Gorgo.
It's perfect. It's this movie in a nutshell.
Yeah. So then my campy. The first time I watched this movie, I didn't quite catch it the second time, but Gorgo's the roar of the kaiju. To me, I was like, what am I listening to? And I think it's a blend. Like I think literally the sound engineer blended the roars of a lion and an elephant. I was like, I'm probably reading into it, but I think that's really funny.
No, I love that. Yeah. In the campy section for me, I think it's gotta be Sean, the wee little orphan. and you know, like, I know that there's sort of some like thematic insights that kind of come out of that character, which is great, but he is very cheesy, very campy at times. And he also has the last line in the movie. I feel like maybe I don't want to give it away. Like, it's not like a twist or anything, but it's like pretty ridiculous. So just imagine a wee little British boy saying something like very cheesy as that's the end of the movie. So yeah.
Oh, so now we come to the moment of truth. And I'll let you go first because I'm still on the fence.
Yeah, I'm on the fence too, to be honest. Although I think in a slightly different way than you are. But the categories that we have, just to reiterate those, are it's a timeless classic. It definitely stands the test of time. There may be some antiquated moments, but overall it's great. And it does stand the test of time. It may be historically significant or just fun, but it does not stand the test of time. And finally, it is not worth revisiting and definitely does not stand the test of time. For me, I think my verdict has to be there may be some antiquated moments, but overall it's great and it does stand the test of time. I don't know if it's like an absolute timeless masterpiece like the original Godzilla or like the original King Kong, for example. But there's so much that's fascinating and beautiful and great and enjoyable about this movie. Ultimately, I really loved it. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm going to have to say ditto to that. I don't think it's a timeless classic for some of those quibbles we had. But I do think it's a lot of fun and just easy on the eyes. Like it's just a good looking movie.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I do think it stands the test of time and is worth watching for your kaiju education. Now, before this, I did not think it stood the test of time. I thought it was fun, but uninspired. It's unoriginal. You're not getting anything new out of this movie. Well, since our conversation, apparently there's a lot you can get out of this movie.
Indeed, yeah. You know, I think like the bare basics of the plot does not seem very original or fresh or creative, but yeah, there's some stuff beneath the surface that I think is really dense, rich, I guess. Like you can pull a lot out of it, you know?
Yeah. Indeed. Cool. All right. Well, that was a great conversation, honestly.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Thank you all for hanging out with us. I'm going to let you know that next month it's Matt's pick. And Matt, what are you bringing to the table?
We're going to start off our road trip with Duel by Steven Spielberg. I've wanted to talk about this movie for a long time on Camp Kaiju because is it a monster movie? Is it not? Who is the monster if it is a monster movie? Who or what is the monster? Yeah, I can't wait to talk about this movie. I love it. I think it's like, I was like Spielberg's first feature, I'm pretty sure. It was a made-for-TV movie, and it's just like so like visceral and well-made. I can't wait to talk about it.
I can't wait for you to talk about it either. No, I'm very excited to see it. I've never seen it. It's a hole in my Spielberg education, so I'm very excited. Following Duel, I will be bringing the movie Rubber to the show. I believe it was from 2013, but it's about a killer tire that becomes alive somehow and goes on a killing rampage. So everybody, please join us on this kaiju road trip. It's going to be a good time.
I can't wait. Yeah. Let's hit the road.
Squealing tires.
Yeah. I had to do the lame pun. I'm sorry.
No, that was perfect because I'm going to use that in the editing.
Thanks for listening, friends. If you like what you hear, please follow, rate, and review this podcast and follow us on Instagram for more monster movie talk. I'm Vincent Hannum with Matt Levine, music by Terrence Jackson. And until next time, stay campy. Oh, and don't forget to visit banditsemporium.com or hit the link in our bio to shop Camp Kaiju t-shirts. banditsemporium.com is our official t-shirt partner, so show them some love while you're at it. You're in good sleeves. Arms. Either way, just use promo code CAMPKAIJU at checkout for that 10% discount. And whatever your style, banditsemporium.com has you covered. As they say, we sell shirts.
We're going back now. Back to the sea.